Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. The Public Accounts Committee publishes a damning report into RTE's financial controls and governance, saying it may have deliberately misrepresented earnings. It recommends that the broadcaster be brought into the remit of the state spending watchdog, the Controller and Auditor General. Also on the programme, Gardaí defend the pace of their investigation into arson attacks at properties suspected of being used to house asylum seekers. They say there's no evidence yet of a national conspiracy.
When I hear people say, you know, these cases are difficult to investigate, it sort of leaves the impression that the investigation is minimal. Quite the opposite. Each and every one of these are being investigated comprehensively, fully, and will continue to be so.
And it's Super Tuesday in the US, with delegates from 15 states expected to all but seal the deal on a Joe Biden-Donald Trump rematch. Iraq's Public Accounts Committee has published a damning report into how RTE has spent public money over the last few years. Based on hours of public testimony and correspondence, the report finds that the broadcaster attempted to circumvent regulations and conceal its underwriting of former presenter Ryan Tuberty's contract. It also could not discount the possibility that RTE deliberately misrepresented the presenter's earnings. The committee has made a series of recommendations, including that the broadcaster come under the remit of the Controller and Auditor General, and that it commits to publishing the salaries of staff earning more than €150,000. The report comes as Media Minister Catherine Martin faces questions over her handling of the issue following a scathing letter from former chair of RTE, Sean Nirahalig. Well, joining me to discuss this are Chair of the Public Accounts Committee, Sinn Féin's Brian Stanley, and two committee members, Green Party TD Mark O'Cahasy and Independent TD Verona Murphy. We're also joined by Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. You're all very welcome along to the programme tonight. Let's talk about the findings, because we've thrashed out these committee grillings since they began last year, Brian, and every new twist and turn into the payments controversy at the national broadcaster. But RTE was taken to task, really, in your report. It was 90 pages long. You know, what for you were the main lines that you wanted to, you know, take from all your committee questioning over the past few months?
I think what we've seen, Claire, in the hearings and in the information and correspondence and the many dozens upon dozens of documents that we received from RTE and from others in relation to this was the complete absence of financial controls, the complete lack and absence in some cases of oversight, not just no transparency, but practices that were actually designed to designed to be used in a deceitful way, complete lack of accountability and just poor governance overall. And they're the basics that, you know, that keeps a corporate outfit on the road and keeps it between the ditches. That wasn't happening at RTE, and that's clear now. And the succession of scandals that you've had and the issues that come out of that, the threads running through it are the failures across those areas. And what we tried to do as a Public Accounts Committee, and Mark and Verona and the other, you know, 12 members altogether, I think, is to try and address those, address the fundamental failures, and in a concise way to make observations, conclusions and observations. And out of that, very, very clear recommendations, 21 clear recommendations that need to be acted on.
OK, and we'll get on to those recommendations in a moment. But Louise, talking about this report, as I say, 90 pages long, we heard, like, you know, every little detail, I think, from those committee hearings in a way that you know, members of the public wouldn't normally pay so much attention to it, but we certainly did since this pay scandal erupted last year. Was there anything new in this report today? Anything we weren't expecting? Anything being highlighted there that may come as a surprise to people?
I mean, I think one thing that the committee members said, and they were launching this report this morning, and you can really see it when you're reading through it, is that some of the stuff and some of the recommendations in it are bog standard, and they are things that should have been in place in RTE for a very long time. And the real question now is, why weren't they? But I mean, when you have things said like that underwriting of the tripartite agreement with RTE, Ryan Tuberty and Renault, that there was a lack of rigorous financial controls when it came to that, when it came to the under-declaration of Ryan Tuberty's salary over those couple of years, and indeed, again, with that Renault deal in there and how RTE paid for that, that the committee could not discount the possibility that figures on Mr. Tuberty's salary were deliberately misrepresented by RTE. And I mean, when you hear things like that about the national broadcaster, this has been thrashed out, and we have heard these conversations had for so long, and we've all seen the lack of governance, the lack of financial control that was there. But when you see it in black and white, it is quite stark. And I do think, and I mean, some of the recommendations, I know we're going to be talking about them in a minute, some of them are quite basic, like things like the committee recommends that all invoices issued by RTE be clearly and accurately labelled as to the goods and services in respect of which they're issued. Like things like that, like
obvious
invoices,
stuff.
Really obvious stuff. And as I think was Alan Kelly said earlier, one of the members here might be able to correct me if it wasn't him, but Alan Kelly said something like, it just shows how bad the situation has been in RTE when you have to recommend really simple stuff like this. So rather than any big surprises, I think a lot of the recommendations have been discussed, have been, you know, really put across by the members at those committee meetings. We've had so many of them now. But I think the most surprising thing of it all really was how basic and how many of them already should have been in place.
Yeah, and putting those, you know, recommendations in place, Verona, were you kind of thinking to yourself, really, should we be doing this? Isn't this basic practice, how to fill out an invoice correctly?
Well, it did appear to people who have been in business that, yes, that would be the case. But clearly that was not the case in RTE for the evidence that was presented to the committee. And I think it feels, you know, probably some of the recommendations are being implemented already, but that doesn't mean that the committee felt they could leave them out. And I think it just goes to show the lack of governance that was in RTE. I mean, where you have a system whereby someone doesn't pay €160 of a TV licence and faces a jail term as a possible sanction, and yet on the other end of the scale, for issues like this where there's lack of governance, there doesn't seem to be accountability other than a golden handshake. And I think that's what's resonating with the public. The fact that huge salaries are paid, you expect competency. And when you get something like this, where you have to recommend basic governance as to be implemented into a structure where it should be very apparent, and there still is no accountability. This is recommendations from the committee. There's no guarantee that they'll be implemented.
Yeah, as I say, 21 recommendations in all, and some of them blindingly obvious, Mark. But let's come to, you know, I suppose the top line recommendation, which is decisions made at RTE should now come under the statutory remit of the Controller and Auditor General, the state spending watchdog. Do you think, because these recommendations will have to go to the Minister for Public Expenditure before they're put to RTE to implement or to adhere, if you like. Do you think there's going to be issues at all around that, the state spending watchdog looking into RTE's finances, given that there's commercial entities as well as a public entity when you look at RTE?
Yeah, well, and I would say a lot of the recommendations really are corporate governance 101. I mean, if the committee felt like we had to state the obvious, that's because the obvious didn't appear to be obvious to the members of the board. But no, it is the headline recommendation of this report that RTE should be brought back under the Controller and Auditor General, which was the case, I think, up until 1990. Brian can correct me if I'm wrong on that. There is going to be a tension there between the public funding and that commercial element. And I think we'd all accept that there will be commercial sensitivities. But I think for the sake of the taxpayer who are funding RTE to the tune of hundreds of millions each year, be it through the licence fee or direct exchequer funding and whatever future model we face into, I think it's incumbent on us to have that level of oversight for the public.
Do you expect there may be pushback to that recommendation?
There may be, and it could be a case that we have to you know, we have to resolve that tension between the commercial and the public aspect in some way. But I think the case to bring it back under the controller and auditor general is incredibly strong. And the entire fiasco that we've seen played out over the last couple of months only strengthens that case. It's a considerable amount of public money, and I think the CNAG is the correct way to provide oversight for that money.
But I think there is already dual auditing, whereby you would have a private auditor to deal with the commercial entity and the CNAG would deal with the public element, the public funding element. So you would see dual auditing. Private company audit the commercial entity to deal with any sensitive issues, commercially sensitive issues, and the CNAG...
Does that add another layer of complexity to all of this?
No, apparently it currently is. It goes on and yeah. It has been, it is currently done within the CNAG's remit. So I think it's from a transparency and public confidence perspective, it's the only way we can go.
Another top line in all of this, Louise, is no confidentiality clauses for departing staff. Is that realistic, really, that, you know, the staff in there will say, yeah, that's fine. If you want to get rid of me, then, yeah, tell the world what you've paid me off. I mean, is it realistic that RT will follow through on that?
I think that's one's going to be rather difficult. And I mean, we have seen the pressure that Kevin Backhurst has come under about these confidentiality clauses, especially the ones that have been signed when he has been the Director General. I think what he has said, and Mr. Backhurst has put this on the record, that if you're trying to exit someone from an organisation, that this is how you do it. And oftentimes, if there's mediation involved, you know, if it ends up going to the Workplace Relations Commission in some cases, there could be confidentiality clauses. I think, you know, I think in an ideal world, there would be no confidentiality clauses because it comes back to this is public money. A lot of it's public money and a lot of people want to see what kind of packages these people are getting. We have seen quite high, quite obscene packages in recent months. So I think it's a great recommendation in theory, but how easy that will be for Kevin Backhurst to implement when he's trying to exit people, when he's trying to transform the organisation, I think that's another question.
Could I just address that one, just maybe to be helpful? What Recommendation 12 actually says is that the committee recommends that RTE ensures that the terms of any new future exit agreement with staff does not contain confidentiality clauses, and goes on, and must also make former employees must cooperate with internal and external inquiries and investigations, including Oireachtas committees like the Public Accounts Committee. That's what it actually says. So, in other words, what it's saying is that Louise is correct. Historical ones, yes, there's, and Kevin Backhurst is, you know, he's quoting legal grounds, and he should do that because obviously he can't hand another bill to the taxpayer in terms of legal fees going down that road. But in terms of future...
But it's existing staff.
What it's saying is that, yeah, with future agreements around exits...
Yeah, but it could apply to existing staff in RTE. It doesn't have to be something that's written into a contract when you...
Yes,
when you,
if you want an exit package...
...when you sign up to work with a broadcaster.
It's also not a brand new recommendation in that the 2016 audit report from the CNAG already has recommended in public sector that there should not be non-disclosure agreements. But it's just taxpayers' money.
But is this part of the problem, that when it comes to RTE, they're not seen as sort of public sector workers, per se, because of the commercial entity that is there and the difficulty around that?
Well, I think the difficulty is that they want it both ways. They are the public service broadcaster, and we have to have that element of trust and confidence in that. But yet, they want to remain semi-state workers when it comes to what every other semi-state has to do, from Caolte to anybody that's in use of public funds.
One of the crucial differences as well with other semi-estates is that a lot of the other ones, by and large, wash their own face. In other words, they're, you know, they have their own strong sources of funding to pay a dividend actually to the state. If you take DSB, Bord na Móna, other companies like that. Whereas the case of RTE, the flow of cash is the other way. So the Oireachtas expects it. We, of the Public Accounts Committee, have a duty to put in their recommendation. And the one thing I'm certain of over the last 8 or 9 months is that listening to the public. The public are not just wishing for this. The public are demanding this. And when it comes, if it's brought back under the CNAG, one very important point is that that directly makes them accountable to the Public Accounts Committee.
What are you expecting by June? Because you have filed this report with 21 recommendations, but you want to see RTE back before you come June.
Most of those recommendations can be implemented within a matter of weeks. What we want to see is a progress report. We want to see an honest effort being made at this. And in relation to what's key to this is that, and you correctly outlined that, the view of government and relevant ministers deeper, public expenditure minister, and indeed the Minister for Media is key to this. You know, the government is a shareholder here through the Minister Martin. And what's important here is that they are implemented in full. You know, if the government think that the public is going to settle for any less than those 21 recommendations, they're reading this wrong. We need to restore public confidence.
But they won't be compelled as such. RTÉ won't be compelled to follow these recommendations.
They have to come back with a damn good reason why. And by and large, Claire, it's worth saying as well that most of the recommendations that comes from the Public Accounts Committee to different accounting officers, secretary generals and ministers, the ministers normally will respond reasonably positive. About, I think it's fair to say 80 or 90% would be, and I'm open to contradiction from my colleagues here on this, 80 or 90% of the recommendations we make are accepted. What I'm saying is in this, because of the scandals that's gone on, is that those 21 recommendations need to be implemented in full. If somebody has a great reason as to why not, they need to be able to explain that to the public and to the bureaucrats.
OK, all right. I want to just move on to Catherine Martin's position in all of this, given the fallout from Siún Ní Ratahlig's damning statement, which has continued into today. When it comes to this, and was Siún Ní Ratahlig speaking about her enforced dismissal, criticising the minister for actively taking a hands-off approach, and that there was clearly a plan to get rid of her, according to Siún Ní Ratahlig. It was a calculated move to reduce her reputation. Outstanding questions now the opposition want to know. What specifically do they want to hear from Catherine Martin about in relation to what Siún Ní Ratahlig has said in her version of events?
But I think the main thing that they're asking for is for a question and answers session with Minister Martin, which by all accounts it seems is not going to be facilitated. It was brought up by quite a few members of the opposition today, including Sinn Féin, Labour, Sock Dems, People Before Profit, all saying that Siún Ní Ratahlig's version of events in that statement on Monday are completely different to Minister Martin's and that she needs to address them. Things like, you know, the kind of the how events unfolded on that Thursday before she did that now infamous prime time interview, how many times she met her. I understand at Cabinet earlier, Minister Martin said that she met Siún Ní Ratahlig at something like 11 times in 9 months. So she's kind of coming out and fighting that back. But I think the big question here is now is when Minister Martin is going to facilitate that question and answer session. What the Taoiseach was saying in the Dáil earlier was that Minister Martin will happily go back in front of the committees when the expert reports are coming out. But they're not expected till the end of March. We have an Easter recess. Is it going to be April before we hear from Catherine Martin? The media, I know my colleagues, I've been asking as well, have been looking to speak to Minister Martin. We're not getting any responses about when she might be speaking to the media. And I mean, the answer is that, you know, she did 3.5 hours in the media committee last week. She did an hour and a half of statements in the Dáil last week. Things have moved on significantly since that, especially with that Siún Ní Ratahlig statement on Monday. So I think there is going to be pressure on Minister Martin to come out and address some of the things that were said about her, because, I mean, she has a right to defend herself, just as Siún Ní Ratahlig did.
Mark, when's she going to do that?
So my understanding is she won't be. There was 3.5 hours of committee last week.
Since then we got yesterday's statement from Siún Ní Ratahlig in which she gives her version of events, which is at odds with Minister Catherine Martin's version of events.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to serve us to have another 3.5 hour session where
the opposition are saying is, can we do a dull Q&A? Why can't that happen?
What the minister has said is she's happy to go back in front of the media committee, but to make best use of everybody's time.
And why not a Dáil committee in front of the Dáil, that she would take questions from the opposition and answer them?
Because there was already a 2-hour session that was devoted to that last week.
Statements.
The government.
There was no.
The minister comprehensively addressed any of the questions that were raised during the
statement. But with these fresh questions that are being asked, okay, so one being around the fact that Siún Ní Ratahlig says, in my 15 months as chair, I only had a handful of meetings directly with the minister.
The minister has clarified that now at Cabinet. And
but the minister
I understand
is saying that.
But
maybe Siún Ní Ratahlig has a different perception.
Well, there's records kept of these meetings. And so between in the 8 months from June to February of last year, there is 11 different meetings. So across 8 months, there's 11 different meetings recorded.
When was the first of those meetings?
The first in June. So within that period, that's from June 22 to February 23, there's a meeting in June, meeting in July, August, September, October, two in November.
June to February. But
this is taken within the period of the crisis. But there was meetings previous to this. So this is when this story first broke.
So you're saying June 23 to February 24. Is that what you're saying? Sorry, you got your years mixed up there,
I have the years wrong here. But yes, so across the period of the crisis, there was There was 11 meetings across those 8 months. That's more than a month.
Right, so Shuni Rahli,
and that's recorded, and that will be shared with the media committee.
What she said in her statement is different now to what we're hearing.
Well, each of those will be recorded
from Catherine. But it's not the minister's just that, diary. Mark. There's so much more. There's the accusation she was a hands-off minister. There was the accusations about how she went on prime time and this was orchestrated, and that Minister Martin went on and said that, you know, this had made its way to the press, so she felt she had to go on and say it on prime time. None of that is being addressed. We have a media minister who doesn't want to speak to the media.
That was addressed comprehensively last week. Respect.
All right, so we're not going to get...
And those factual details, the actual choreography of that Thursday interview hasn't changed, even in light of the statement.
OK, so, Mark, the line from the Green Party tonight is Catherine Martin will not be addressing the Dáil on this matter again.
Not during this week. The order of business was set for this week
not
coming
happening
in Tuesday
this week.
Earlier.
Brian, do you think this is important? Do you think any of it is important?
I think a proposal from the opposition was rejected by government. I think what's important, and it's not about, you know, having hearings and more hearings, it's about drawing a line, and in the report today we try to do that. To somewhat, other issues are going to arise, make no mistake about that, over the coming months. But this is about putting a framework in place. So a template and having a framework with it.
But
getting the basis right. But just in relation to the minister and the former chair, in relation to that particular issue, I think that given the statement from Shuni Rahli, who's been in before meetings of the Dáil committees over the last 8 months and before that, I think she's come out with a statement that does completely contradict a lot of the key points that the minister was using as her the basis of her defence. And that's fair enough. And the minister's entitled to do that. I accept that she was in the committee. I accept that there was statements made, but statements is different than questions. And I think given the fact that this is coming, don't forget that the chair of the board of RTE, that is the oversight body over all of this, over all the mess that has happened, they've been there throughout all of this crisis, Shuni Rahli. So she's in a key position, or has been in a key position, up to a week ago. I think what she had to say can't be just brushed to one side.
Okay, so I think
if the minister, you know, there's obviously a difference in terms of what evidence here. I think it's important that there's a short hearing in the Dáil, questions on a Q&A session, do it, get out of the way, because we have to start putting these issues to bed and move on.
Well, I'm thinking
can't drag on forever.
Well, I'm thinking of the 21 recommendations that are contained within, you know, the PAC report, and then you have a situation where we have a new person in the hot seat, Terence O'Rourke, who has to pick up the pieces here. So, I mean, does there need to be more at this stage to... would you expect improved protocol, say, Verona, between the minister and the new chair here? That there's more transparency about the process and face-to-face meetings?
There has to be lessons learned. I remember the first of the committee meetings where I put it to Shuni Rahli and the chief executive of RTE that they had essentially thrown Ryan Tuberty under the bus. It would appear now that the minister has thrown, as Shuni Rahli sees it, her under the bus. What I'm disappointed about is that it has taken that and a resignation from the chair to bring forward any of her complaints. I find that very disingenuous that she has complained now, having resigned, that the minister didn't have a hands-on approach. I mean, what value is in that? It sounds and looks like sour grapes because it's after the fact. I think we need to move on. I think the minister herself will be held to account by the electorate. When she goes to the polls, the electorate will decide whether or not she did a good job. And I think ultimately there are some very serious recommendations. People want to see accountability. They want trust and confidence.
So sorry, Fernie, you would have expected Shuni Rahli to come...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
To have come out before now.
Well, I think she's come out now and said that basically that the minister's telling lies.
Is that because Catherine Martin did the interview last week on television where she said she was deeply disappointed?
It seems like is sour grapes. It seems like she's not going to sit back and take it. She resigned. I mean, if there was a reason why didn't she have the meeting? Why didn't she accept the letter?
Did she have a choice?
Well, I think, did Ryan Tuberty? I mean, this is where it all comes back to at the end of the day. The media can be very cruel, especially to their own.
And I think the department will have the receipts in terms of those 11 meetings across 8 months as well.
All right. Well, we'll await more on that. We'll have to take a break for now. My thanks to Brian Stanley. The others are staying on with me. Coming up next, Gardaí defend their investigation into arson attacks linked to accommodation for asylum seekers. Welcome back. Senior Gardaí have told an Oireachtas committee that there's no evidence of an overarching conspiracy behind the spate of arson attacks at properties believed to be earmarked to house asylum seekers. TDs and senators were told that the country has been fortunate so far that we haven't suffered deaths as a result of the attacks. Well, earlier, the chair of the Justice Committee, James Lawless, revealed his own frustration at the pace of the Garda investigations and the low number of arrests so far.
It is, to be honest, a source of frustration to me as chair of this committee. I think that we haven't seen more arrests and more investigations and prosecutions. I know there's a sequence that, you know, you don't have to go straight to court. You know, obviously you have to investigate, detect, arrest, question, charge. You know, there's a cycle there and there's a lead time involved. But I've heard it said many times, and perhaps not by the Gardaí, in fairness, perhaps it's been commentary in the media, but I've heard it said that it's difficult to investigate these crimes because one of the reasons the evidence is burned. But again, I'm not sure if I fully accept that because we see, for example, an insurance fraud. You know, it's not a new thing that a building is burned for an insurance claim. You know, that happens. That's happened for centuries. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that there is a way to do this. Again, I suppose without getting into operational issues, are those kind of techniques being employed here? And what are the challenges that are posed?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important, because when I hear people say, you know, these cases are difficult to investigate, it sort of leaves the impression that the investigation is minimal. Quite the opposite. Mm. What I would say is that each and every one of these are being investigated comprehensively, fully, and will continue to be so. And while a number of arrests have been made, as I pointed out in my statement, I'm confident that more will be forthcoming. It's a matter of timing, because that kind of forensic analysis, that kind of comprehensive investigation, it takes time, but it is happening.
Well, joining us to discuss this is Niamh McDonald from the Hope and Courage Collective, who also gave evidence at today's Justice Committee hearing. We're also joined again by Green Party TD Mark O'Cahasy, Independent TD Verona Murphy, and by Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Niamh, to come to you on this, because you gave a statement, you contributed to today's Justice Committee hearing. When we hear that there's no overarching conspiracy linking arson attacks that we've seen at accommodation centres and locations earmarked for asylum seekers, does that chime with your research? Because you're researching extremism and far right, that those behind these attacks are operating independently.
Well, I suppose legally, the police have to reach a certain bar of evidence, and we have to acknowledge that. But at the same time, there's patterns emerging around these arson attacks. And the patterns that we're seeing where prominent extremists show up at centres or proposed centres or rumoured centres, there's an increased probability of an arson attack. You know, and so what we want to see, there may not be a chain of evidence, but there are patterns emerging. And what we wanted to know from the police today, what is their kind of operational approach to that? So was there a prevention approach? And that was not clear coming from the committee. And they did not have a response in the committee when they were asked.
This is specifically when it comes to arson attacks and attacks that are being carried out on accommodation.
That was the approach of the committee, yeah.
Yeah, because we have heard in relation to this, Mark, that, you know, flyers are sent around in a locality where there is, say, a centre that's earmarked for asylum seekers, saying this is going in your community, in your locality, and, you know, we're protesting this, they're opposed to this, and they want people, you know, to get behind a rally opposing accommodating asylum seekers here. So And yet, with all of that, we've only had 11 arrests so far. Many people saying these centres are not being protected and arson attacks can happen.
Yeah.
And they are happening right across the country.
And I'd be concerned about the leaflets, but I'd be more concerned about that unseen part, like what's going on in Telegram groups, how it's been circulated in social media. I am glad to see some arrests being made in this, because whether or not there's an orchestrated conspiracy, people feel a sense of permission, I think, from seeing examples in other communities. Mm-hmm. I do think there's at least, and I would say at least, a copycat element in it here. And I'm very glad to see that there's going to be some very public dissuasion from what is...
What's the public dissuasion?
Arrests.
Well, 11 hopefully arrests so far, but no prosecutions.
Well, I hope they will follow in due course. Okay. I do accept that it's painstaking. I'd like to see it happen a lot quicker, because I think a very clear message has to go out that this is criminal behaviour.
All right.
And it carries very serious consequences, and I want to see that carry through.
OK, because we had these arson attacks, I think, since, you know, last year in all. I think there's been 28, yeah, well, before
first attack, there's been 23 attacks since 2018. The first is in Mauville, mm-hmm. but most recently over the last 18 months, there's been a rapid increase in arson attacks. And we can see a number of the playbook of hate and extremism and how it's built towards this. This is not a surprise. We've been talking about this for 2 years, that the increased violent rhetoric and violent acts that's online, that's not on unregulated social media. These are companies for profit who are sharing hate and extremism without any consequence. And then in turn, what's happening in communities that arson has no consequence. So it's working together to build up a head of steam. So we can't just police our way out of this. There's social media regulation. There is a policing approach, but there's also kind of proactive, positive engagement with communities. And so I think there's like, and the government also, their narrative since kind of January 2014 has been to start to say we're cracking down on asylum, to roll back on policies for people seeking asylum. Mm. We see men sleeping on the streets in the snow. This is almost like, you know, appeasing the far right and emboldening the small group of extremists that are trying to weaponise very real material issues that are in our communities across the country.
Would you agree with that, Fiona?
From what aspect?
From what Niamh is saying, that I suppose what the government rhetoric or the statements coming out around, you know, cracking down and clamping down, they may not be using those exact words.
I
think there was a question before about a clamp down.
Well, in the same vein, I don't believe that
there are increased measures saying being looked into, ensuring that, you know, people coming here are genuine asylum seekers and all of that, that they're going to sort of
I'd just like to say at the outset that anybody who is found to be an arsonist should face the full rigours of the law. I mean, it's attempted murder. Well, it's going to be dreadful the day it comes where somebody is actually killed in one of these fires or dies because of one of these fires. But I think the reality is we can't just label anybody who is protesting. No, I appreciate that, Niamh, and we've discussed it before. Far right. I think we have a serious issue in Rosslare. It is a planning issue. There are protests. There has been no incident of arson that I'm aware. There was a fire of a machine. I'm not aware of it being an arson attack, albeit that it may have been reported at some point. But I think the reality is that we need to do much better where we are looking after asylum seekers, where we are in general in our housing. There's no point in saying it, that all of this has given rise to an element where the media reported as being far right. In order for the government to detract from its failures, they accuse everybody of being far right.
I don't agree with that at all.
Well, I think it has been there right back to November where the riots took place in Dublin. I think, you know, far right extremism. The reality is we have very serious issues.
Are you saying that there's within the Dublin riots that there was not far right extremism?
What I'm saying is that it was flagged at the time that it should have been evident from social media that that was about to happen. And I think what we're hearing today from the committee is that there is no, the Gardaí are investigating it, and it's not given rise that there is any, I suppose, network out there, that these are all individual episodes. But I hear what Niamh is saying, and I take on board that, of course...
But they follow what Niamh is saying, is it does follow a pattern of extremism, that we are seeing, that even if people are operating independently...
I don't disagree. So do many trends, and that's the issue with social media. And what Niamh is saying is that social media has taken no responsibility.
I think there's two things happening here. There's a playbook of extremism. That's a playbook that's recognised across the world, of causing fear, weaponising issues. I'm not excusing the government. The government have a massive role to play in this by kind of engaging with communities and meeting the needs of communities. But also we have to look at the role that of hate and extremism and the playbook and how social media amplifies that playbook. It's not just social media. Social media is a tool that they use that needs to be recognised. But there is hate and extremism, and it is networked across this country, and we cannot deny that, and we see that day in, day out, and we cannot appease it.
All right, I want to ask Louise as well, because it was also brought up about the Garda handling around protests, and has the approach to date been correct? Some voicing frustrations where Gardaí have not stepped in, say in roads being blockaded when you know, a busload of people coming to be accommodated or trying to get down a road, and that they are not stepping in. I mean, what's the response been there? Gardaí are saying, look, we are trying to tread a line here, but certainly it's frustrated many people.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm from a community myself where we had protests during the summer, and yes, there were some far-right people there, but there was also a local community there, and it's when you get them two together, and there was roads blocked, and there was many nights I was trying to get up the road and I couldn't because guards were turning me around, and it doesn't only frustrate them, it frustrates the local community. And I think Drew Harris was out on this, and he has been out on this a number of times, and especially over the summer, what he was saying is you don't want to play into these people's hands, that by reacting to them, you then give them what they want, and you give them their click for social media, you give them whatever else. But I think what a lot of politicians are saying is, well, it actually looks like you're doing nothing. It looks, lets them think that they have the complete run of the place, where if it was anyone else, perhaps they would be stopped. They wouldn't be allowed blockade roads. If it was another protest, they wouldn't be allowed to do that. So I think, you know, I think there has to be a balance in between not playing into their hands, not agitating them any further, but also not allowing them to hold communities to ransom either.
But I think, just to be clear, there's a difference where someone is protesting and there is proper planning in place and they're legitimately able to use the building as an IPAS centre. In Rosslare, there's a legitimate protest. There is absolutely a planning process at play where it's being questioned and there is no planning in place. So I think there's some very different understanding of what protest is here, and where it can't be one rule for one and another rule for just, you know, that you can just obfuscate any planning rules.
But surely there's a line then that protesters may step over and that Gardaí then have to make a decision on how they act in those circumstances. Niamh, I want to ask you about that, because it certainly came under the spotlight about the Garda approach to date and whether it is the correct approach, or is there a sense that, you know, protesters, but those who step over the line, blockade roads, intimidate people, you know, and when it becomes violent, are they being allowed to get away with it?
I think we have to separate legitimate and democratic right to protest that we have in this country, and a difference about kind of, you know, violently disrupting, blockading, stopping people from coming to their homes. These people are seeking asylum and their accommodation is going to be their homes. That's stopping people from entering into their homes. There has been violence. We saw in Selbridge last week what happened, where there was a truth or a lie, so it suddenly became the truth. And suddenly there was like a very kind of violent mobilisation outside a centre and calling for violence against people who were living there and blocking the roads. And this was not stopped. So there has to be a clear line where there is kind of violence, intimidation and threats of violence compared to legitimate right to protest. And we cannot confuse the two. Yeah. But also there is a preventative message here that needs to... And the government have had 2 years. The Ukraine war has been on for 2 years. We are still in an emergency mode. There has to be a full governmental approach to this. And it's not handled in that way. And there's not respect for communities on the ground are seen as stakeholders. So the government have a lot to answer here, and we cannot just blame kind of hatred and extremism, and the government needs to start engaging and respecting communities
all
much
right
more.
We are out of time on that, but thank you. We will leave it there. My thanks to Niamh McDonald, to Mark O'Cahasy and to Verona Murphy. Coming up after the break, we're live to Washington as delegates from 15 states cast their ballots for Super Tuesday.
Welcome back. Former US President Donald Trump is seeking to take the reins today as Republican candidate for president as delegates from 15 states cast their ballots. He's aiming to all but eliminate the last remaining contender, Nikki Haley, from the race and set up the now likely showdown with current President Joe Biden. Well, I'm joined down the line from Washington by correspondent Simon Marks and from London by Greg Swenson, chair of Republicans Overseas UK. Simon, to come to you first, 15 states going to the polls today, Super Tuesday, as it were, but it's a bit of a damp squib, really, isn't it? It's all very predictable.
Yes, I think that's right, Claire. Certainly compared to previous years. I mean, this is traditionally the day when the race for the nomination goes national. And at the end of this Super Tuesday, normally we see various candidates staring defeat in the face and accepting that they need to suspend their presidential campaigns. We're in a different position this time around. We know who the two candidates this November are going to be. It's going to be a rematch of 2020 between Joe Biden for the Democrats and Donald Trump for the Republicans. Donald Trump will not mathematically get his arms around the Republican Party's presidential nomination today, but he may well do so in a week's time or possibly a fortnight. Certainly by the time the middle of April rolls around, he absolutely will be the presumed Republican nominee. And so what we're looking at today is more subtle than the kind of the horse race. What is turnout going to be? To what extent can one draw conclusions from that about the lack of enthusiasm voters may have for Joe Biden on the Democratic side and for Donald Trump on the Republican side? How substantial is the Never Trump vote that Donald Trump's last remaining ally, Nikki Haley, can mobilise? It seems unlikely that she's going to win a single state tonight. That would be a real upset if she was able to eke out a victory in one or two of them. And what does she do next? Does she keep slogging away, enduring defeat after defeat? Or is this the night when she throws in the towel? But at the end of the day, you know, there are millions of Americans out there who would much rather that this election was not going to be a rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and low turnout being reported all over the country suggests that there are Americans who have decided to vote with their feet and stay at home.
What's the speculation then, Simon Marks, on what Nikki Haley will do? Will she finally call it quits after tonight?
Well, it's very difficult to see what the purpose is of her continuing, assuming she goes down to defeat across the board. If her plan is to try and bank some political capital ahead of a possible presidential run in 2028, well, she's already accomplished that. If she wants to secure a speaking role at the Republican Party's convention in Milwaukee in July, well, she might carry on in a bid to try and notch up delegates here and there so that she can then go to the Trump-controlled Republican National Committee and say, I deserve a primetime spot. I think it's very unlikely they would give her one. There is a third possibility that she might launch a third-party run for the presidency. Last weekend, Nikki Haley said that she would not necessarily consider herself bound by a pledge she signed last August to support the eventual Republican nominee. We know that's going to be Donald Trump. Now it seems she's giving a rethink in that regard.
All right, Simon Marks joining us from Washington. Thank you very much for the very latest from there, and we'll see how it all plays out and if it does so as expected in the coming hours. I think it's an hour and 15 minutes when we'll get the first results in from the states. Greg Swenson also joins us tonight. Greg, thank you for being with us. What about this idea of a third party run here with Nikki Haley, given that she's all but out now?
It's a bit of a curveball. And I think, you know, Nikki Haley said on a few occasions in the last few weeks that she would not consider that. She would not consider running as a third party candidate or with the so-called no labels campaign. But then again, politicians often say those things and avoid the press on certain questions that will make them feel uncomfortable and then change their minds. That's not unusual in politics. I think it would be very bad news for President Trump, because she would take some of those moderate and independent votes that you know seem to support her, you know, kind of the Republicans in name only. I hate to use that term, but that might be something that would really hurt the president. it's not likely because third party candidates never work out. It's even in a time like this where you have two very unpopular candidates, 75% of Americans don't want to see Trump v. Biden again. I still think a third party candidacy is a real stretch.
You know what you're saying there? 75% of Americans do not want to see this rematch. What way are they going to vote?
Well, at this point, if unless you see a major third party candidate come in, and again, I don't think Nikki Haley would do this because it would probably end her career as a Republican. But it looks like right now, President Trump is definitely leading in the polling. He's leading not just in the popular vote. He's leading in the swing states, the very important five or six swing states that you need to win to win the delegates. I mean, the election. But more importantly, he's leading on all the issues. And I think people are starting to ignore, you know, some of the chaos and drama that was associated with the Trump administration from 2017 to 20, and looking at his policies, his outcomes, and let's look at the issues that Americans care about. And on those metrics, he's winning.
Greg, I mean, in terms of his policies and who he's trying to attract in terms of votes, what sort of Trump campaign are we going to see from here? Because he is looking to get new voters and people who wouldn't have voted for him last time out over the line. Is that going to be a challenge?
I think it will be a challenge. I hope he embraces it because, at least according to the New York Times Siena poll over the weekend, 97% of the people that voted for him in 2020 will vote for him again. That's a very good sign for him. Not a very good sign for President Biden, where he's only polling at 83 on that metric. But I think it would be really it's really important for President Trump to reach out to the voters that he doesn't have. You need those swing voters. You need those independents. You need the people who might not like him, but if he embraces that, you know, kind of reaches out to them with the policies.
How are they going to start liking him, Greg? That's the question. If they didn't like him before, what's going to make you turn around and say, Trump's the man for me?
I think one thing, Claire, and that's that if people can hold their nose and ignore some of the things they don't like, but understand that his policies are remarkably mainstream. You know, he's not some radical right, super conservative or extreme. You know, he's not an extremist by any means. He might be extremist with his unfiltered rhetoric, but if you look at his policies, he's actually mainstream. I'm much more conservative than President Trump. I think Nikki Haley, you could argue, is more conservative than Trump, but his policies that he's endorsing are much more center-right and mainstream America. I think might work for him.
Greg, we have to leave it there. I'm sure many would disagree with you on that stateside. However, we'll see how it all plays out. We do appreciate it. That is it from us. Our program is available as a podcast. But from us, good night and do take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.